Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome back to Nothing Major. I'm Sam Querrey. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, John Isner, Jack Sock, and Steve Johnson.
All right, fellas, we've got a U.S. Open-themed episode this week. Also going to bring our producer, Charlie, in, and we will have to guess some of our past quotes. And finally, we're going to wrap with mailbag questions from listeners. But first, John, how do you want to kick this off?
When did y'all feel the most pressure going in to a U.S. Open? And we all played that tournament a bunch of times. And for me, every year was really not the same. So I think I'd like to hear from y'all. It's something I don't really know, actually.
I always felt the most pressure on actually the years that I wasn't playing well. Or like I had a bunch of losses and I went into the Open and I was like, oh, I got to like find a way to like get a win or two here. Where the years that I was playing well, I literally felt no pressure. I was like, I'm probably going to win here. Like confidence is high. So it was those years that you're not playing well where I personally felt the most pressure.
Early in my career, I felt the most pressure. You know, you want to do so well at the U.S. Open, at your home slam. I grew up watching it, obviously, for 19 years before I got to play it. So I was always very nervous in my first couple of years in 2010, 11, 12. And then after that, you know, the expectation, you know, there was no expectation to win or, for pretty much all the years. But so it became a little bit easier in that regard for me, not having to deal with that pressure. So I actually enjoyed the U.S. Open probably, you know, from 2015 to, you know, to my last year, which was last year. So those were just more of an enjoyable experience, getting to enjoy all of what New York, what the U.S. Open, the chaos, the electricity that New York can bring.
Yeah, I think I might be actually the other way around. I felt like early years, there was zero pressure. I feel like it was going in like, I don't know, one of the new guys on the block type of thing, and was swinging free, and you know, no one knew what to expect for anyone, you know, myself or anyone kind of coming in around that time. And I actually felt like the, you know, either higher ranked you got or better you did on tour in general, and then like the later years going, felt more pressure because you're expected to, you know, maybe win a few rounds, try to make the second week was always a thing. I obviously had some physical issues at the Open a few times that was disappointing with some cramping and stuff like that. So
I witnessed that firsthand, Jack.
Yeah, it was not fun at all. I don't know how many people used to be in the old grandstand could sit in there, but it felt like a packed house that day, and getting, you know, helped off the court, just dying out there. It was not enjoyable, but
we all remember it well.
Yeah, it was.
Gosh.
So Jack was finishing his match. I mean, this is back in the days where grandstand, as you guys know, and Louis were right beside each other.
So hot.
That was a hot box out there. That thing was, it was ridiculous.
Louis Armstrong and grandstand shared that same little corridor right there. You go left to Louis Armstrong and right to grandstand, but you go to the same entrance. And I knew Jack's match was literally about to finish. I'm walking onto Armstrong. I get in the corridor and poor Jack's getting helped off, full body cramp, like arms are stuck, like legs.
They couldn't even help me. They were like, we can't give you a drink some water and some power. Yeah. And I was like,
who are you playing? I don't remember that, but.
Bemelmans, I think, or something. I don't know.
Okay. But it was just hot.
It was disgusting.
Super hot New York day. And I felt so bad for Jack.
And I'm a perfuse sweater. It was,
Yeah.
Mixed for a disaster. But anyways, I felt later on, I felt a little more pressure the more years I played. And then it's like less and less U.S. Opens are left, you know, probably in the career type of thing. So I was happy with, you know, some of the double success, I guess, later on for me. But I always loved the event. I think I was always a little worried about the physical stuff with sweating and the heat going in. And it always kind of had a little doubt in my mind.
How about for you guys? You know, I know the 1 week in my career that I was the number one ranked American happened to be at the Open. You know, in 2016, did you guys feel any pressure when you were the highest ranking American? Because I know all you guys were at one point at the Open. Like, I mean, for me, like, there was no pressure because nobody ever expected us to win. You know what I mean? Like, it was always Roger, Rafa, Novak, like, whatever. So I didn't feel like any added pressure as being the highest ranked American. What about you boys?
Not really. I mean, John was the most, was in that position the most.
You get comfortable with it, John, or is it like you don't even think about it?
And like, we're the number one American, maybe seated at what, like 12, 13 or whatever it is. Like, so I think at that stage, you definitely want, at the very least, you want to make your seed. You do want to try to make it into the second week. And at that point, it's all gravy. For me, it was the couple days in New York City before the first round that was always like, golly, like these days, like they take way too long. You just want to get on the court and play, and you want to play well. The best feeling for me was winning that first round match, sort of finally just getting over that hurdle. You've been waiting a few days in New York City to play that, getting over that match. Then you start to settle in and get into a bit of a rhythm. But it's, as you guys know, it's hectic. It's so crowded at the courts. You know, if you're Tuesday at fourth match on, you got forever to wait. And it's just, Stevie, you and I would joke that Sam will always have like good schedules. I always feel like Sam would play like.
Sam had the best schedules every time. It's ridiculous.
It's a good schedule. One tournament in Miami 9 years ago, and you guys bring it up every week.
Sam would play Monday at 11 a.m. in New York and like win. And I knew I was like Tuesday fourth up. And he's like, all right, John, see you later. And he's like going to the hotel after he won his first round. I'm like, I hate this.
One of the greatest feelings in tennis was the day off after a slam win.
Great feeling.
Oh, yeah.
One of the greatest feelings.
Like, but after a second round slam win, when you're into the third round.
Yeah.
Walking through the player lounge, everyone's like, good job. You're just like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Get to the courts and all your buddies are stressing because they got to play. They're gripping rackets. They're making their drinks. And you know, like, you just had a nice little 45-minute tickle and you eat some lunch and be off on your way.
When I was confident, though, like at the 2017 – it didn't matter who you were playing in the first round. I felt mentally like I was going to beat anyone.
Totally.
I played like Jill Simone first round, who was really good. And I remember in my head thinking, there's no way I'm going to lose to Jill Simone. I have so much confidence. And then like, it's completely flipped if you're not playing well. You'd be like, oh my gosh, I got to play like Jill Simone. Like, this is going to be a battle. I hope I can get through it.
I think I'm weirdly the other way. I feel like when I wasn't playing well, I'd go in and be like, I'm just gonna play super free because I haven't been playing that well. And if I win, it's gonna be a boost of confidence. And like, I'm not expecting myself to even win a match. And then that can kind of like flip around either the season or a few weeks. Like after finishing top 10, then Australia, I was an 8 seed at a slam, never seen that. And that's when I was like, you know, I had a great first round or potential draw and just wasn't like ready to kind of.
Did you play Sugita?
Yeah, sure did.
I don't know why I know that, but.
Yeah, sure did. I sure did.
Yeah, Sugita was like a little Japanese samurai out there. He was kind of scary.
He was tough.
He was good.
Yeah.
No. He just like, he had this like scowl on his face. The headband, the long headband.
I think honestly, by the time like the Open rolled around that year after, you know, the year after my good year was like, I didn't even have expectation at that point. Probably still lost first round, but yeah, I'm kind of the other way on that. Were you guys look ahead in the draw, guys, or like one round by round?
No, I would try not to.
One of my biggest pet peeves is people who say they don't look at the draw.
Yeah.
That's such a lie. I don't look at second rounds. You cannot look at a section of a draw and not see like the other like eight people around you. And
I mean, like, that's not kind of true. You could tell you ask your coach, like, who do you play? And that's it. That's all you want to know. I would try to do that. I didn't want to look ahead.
Come on.
What do you mean? Robbie Ginepri didn't want to know what his draws were. Like, I mean.
One time I was with Neps going to the French Open and he was like, who do you play? I was like, I play you. He was like, oh, well, I didn't want to know. Yeah.
No, that is classic.
I remember being on the practice court, the French. I think it was Neps' last French, and he wanted to like try it. And I think I was hitting with him or on the court, sharing a court with him. And he was like, he didn't want to look at it. And then the draw comes out. And I think Berger was with me. And he was like, you play Rafa. And he's like, booked his flight home 2 days later.
One of my biggest pet peeves is when a friend would text me before a slam. They say, I love your draw. I think you can beat so-and-so in the third round. I'm like, you mother effer. Drive me insane. My brother would do it. Like, you got a great draw, dude. I'm like, Jordan, stop.
He did that to me. Your own brother did that to me. Like,
And he would do it all the time. He was like, I think you're going to beat Fed in the round of 16. I'm like, dude.
But in fairness, I think John played Philip Kohlschreiber like 7 times in a row in the round of 32. Did you not?
Yeah, three in a row and three in a row and three L's. I actually have a winning record over that dude lifetime.
Wait, really?
I think I'm like 4-3 against him. Yeah, I just happened to lose to him 3 times in the third.
You'd flip that right now. If you'd rather be 3-4 and have those three
100%
wins.
100%, dude. He beat me center court Ash third round, and we finished. I like. I almost set another record, like 2:40 in the morning. He beat me on Armstrong twice. I mean,
it was every year. It was just like,
yeah,
he was such a dangerous, like, 30 to 40 guy. Yeah. He just didn't want to, like,
he was a royal pain in the ass for me.
He was ranked 33 for like 9 years. Like, never would never be
That's
seated.
That's what I felt like. Yeah.
Oh no, he was always seated like 29.
I thought he was always seated 32.
Yeah, I guess he was always between like 28 and 35.
Because when I played him in the slams, we were both seated. It was always, maybe it was like I was 12 and he was 24. You know, it's like kind of always.
Did Philip Kohlschreiber retire? I feel like I never
saw
him.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah, he had a good career. A smooth game.
Does anyone have any good draw stories?
I had one time flying to New York from Winston, and I was on the plane with Andreas Seppi, and we land. Such a nice guy, by the way, as we all know.
Great guy.
And we land, and we're at, like, the baggage claim, and he asked me who I play. And I knew, I did know who I played first round, and I knew it was a really, really good draw. And I didn't even want to say it, because it was his countryman. I go, I played Filippo Valandri, acting like, you know, it's a tough one. And because he was ranked, like, 99th. And he starts laughing. I'm like, what's so funny? He goes, he's still in Italy right now.
This was like Saturday like, before the Open.
This is like the 3 days before the tournament. No. I'm like, shit, I cannot blow this. Like, the dude he's just coming over here for a check. He's literally still in it. I knew I hadn't seen
him. Is that your first 6-0 set ever?
Yeah, I did beat him 6-0. I ended up taking care of business because he was pretty bad. He played zero hard court matches. He was like 99 or something in the world. So he's into the main draw. So of course he's going to fly over from, you know, Naples or whatever to New York City and show up and take it. But I was so tight for like 2 days because like, I can't blow this against Valandri. But anyways, ended up taking care of business.
Yeah, here's a bit of a natural transition here. We are at the time of the year, week before the Open, the busiest time of the year, especially for American players. We feel like it's our home slam. We have a lot of obligations, media, sponsors, tournament. What was your busiest time? How did you manage your sponsors, you know, Prince, Fila, Nike, all the things that you were sponsored by, you know, week before the Open? How did you do it? Did you like to play the week before? Did you like to get up there a week early to kind of knock stuff out, you know, beforehand? You know, well, take us through those kind of days.
Early in my career, I liked to play the week before. I played New Haven a few times. We all know the old New Haven tournament. But then that tournament moved to Winston-Salem, which is my
another hometown,
third hometown.
Okay, yeah.
My actual hometown. So, like, of course I'm going to play that event. I get to sleep in my childhood bed, even though I didn't fit in it very well. But
is it a twin bed?
No. Actually, I had a nice like queen type thing situation going on. But I got to be at home and like while my like with my mom like cooking me food, it just like brought me back. And here I am like some 30-year-old like living at home the week before the US Open. But it was great. I loved being in Winston-Salem the week before. But even when I stopped playing Winston-Salem, I did not like to get up to New York early. Like it was the last thing I wanted to do. Like I would stay in Dallas or Tampa, wherever I was living, as long as I possibly could. And the only reason I would have to get up there, Stevie, to answer your question, were some sponsor obligations I had. And I would try to put them off to the last minute. And there's sometimes I would fly up on Saturday before the US Open. Because in my mind, like a hard court's a hard court. I don't really feel like you got to get used. I think people overdo that.
For sure they do.
Personally, I mean, some people will be in New York for like 10 days before their first match, like driving in and out of the city, 45 minutes, hour each way. Like, talk about getting crispy. Like, for me, I just want to be at home practicing in my little routine. New York's easy to get to. There's a bazillion flights a day. Get up there as late as possible. But then, yes, the sponsor stuff you would have, most of it would be like in the city. It wouldn't necessarily be on site. So I'd go to like some Prince, you know, photo shoot or activation deal. I remember doing one at that ping pong club, Spin, it was called. You know, so you kind of try to schedule that stuff like late in the afternoon. It's not really what I wanted to be doing because I don't like hanging out in the city. It's not really for me. It's the pace is way too fast. And it just kind of wears on you. So that's why I think we're all sort of pretty similar, you know, like getting up to New York, like really, really early, man, that's the last thing I wanted to do.
You know, I don't know about you guys, but like, I hate it. I was like, I did everything before Sunday. If I could, like nothing was Sunday, like before the slam, like, you know, I always played Winston cause I hated getting to New York early. So even if I got up there like Friday night, Saturday, I would do, you know, at the time it was either Babolat or Yonex, A6, whatever it was like, I will do everything Saturday to do nothing Sunday. Like just get it all out of the way.
Just so you knock it all out.
Only had to prepare for that match on Monday or Tuesday or whatever. But what about you, JS?
Yeah, definitely people, probably your standard tennis fan, have no idea what goes into it. And like you said, for us, it's probably the busiest week of the year. And it's probably the only week where, you know, some players on tour like to schedule practices at tournaments 6 months in advance, and it's kind of insane. But like, that is the one. That is the one. It's, you know what I'm talking about? Like, you
totally.
Know, yeah. Like Schwartzman hit you with a text like, "Do you want to practice in Buenos Aires next year?" I was like, "I don't even know what I'm playing." That is the one. That is the one week of the year I feel like where you had to actually plan out probably weeks ahead of time, like you said, with commitments and obligations. And I remember like early on with Nike, I had just coming on tour or just started doing well or something, and I remember having, I feel like I had something every day. I got in there like a Monday night, and I like Tuesday through Saturday was just like, there's something going on every day with Babolat, Nike. Like they put a cord up like on a pier somewhere, and we'd go down, yeah. And like it took like hours on end, and
like small talk with the German Adidas rep.
Yeah,
and then you're schlepping all your bags like through New York City, you're like hailing a cab with like four bags.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And then you look down the street, and you see nine other players walking down the road with all their bags too, and it's just like, yeah, the U.S. Open's here. Yeah, definitely very hectic.
I feel like I never had like that much to do. If it was that much, it was like pretty easy. Like sometimes I didn't like it. You'd hear players like complain, like not to throw Jack under the bus, like, oh, I gotta do this Nike thing. Like they're giving people hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I wasn't complaining.
You're not complaining. You weren't complaining. You just happened to be in my screen, so I had to use you as an example. But you know, I always thought it was a good thing if you're at the Open and like your agent's texting you a lot. Like that just means you're playing well. A lot of sponsors, a lot of people like want your time and energy. So I mean, I don't know what like Roger and Rafa are going through every slam, but you wanted your agent like with you basically the entire week before. That just means you were like good.
On that note, any funny appearances that stood out in a good or a bad way?
I have one that's just kind of funny.
Stevie, what happened to you?
I want to say it was an ASICS thing, but it was at this little tennis shop, like in the middle of the city that like, you know, like it's so like off the beaten path. Like if you want to do something, like do it at the courts or do like where all the tennis is. I sat there for like an hour. Not one person came. Like, and I'm like, you know, I don't really care. I just sat there for an hour, like with like, you know, your like little,
just like a little autograph table and like a Sharpie and a bunch of Stevie Johnson cards.
Correct. You know, it's not even like the shop was like two people came into the shop. Like it's Saturday at like 11 a.m. Like, you know, nobody's shopping for tennis.
Like, they probably came in and like bought some string and left. And
I was just like, this is just uncomfortable. Like, why couldn't we do this like on site? I was just like, can I leave after like 20? They're like, I think people are going to come. I'm like, I don't think so. I really don't think. This was like 20, you know, 12 or 13. So I was like just on tour. Like, you know, I was like, this is a long hour. It was a long hour. I just sat there.
That's brutal.
Sam, what do you think is more uncomfortable, that or you and I in Vegas this past December being a part of the Rafa Alcaraz EXO and being at the same like welcome party the night before?
Yeah.
That was like we were there to like, you know, take photos or sign stuff. Like
nobody right wanted you guys? Them.
No. We were at the Netflix Slam event earlier this year and Rafa was playing Alcaraz and then you and I somehow were there as well. And Taylor Fritz and Francis Tiafoe were also part of the event, but they didn't come to the dinner the night before, so they weren't there. And it was just like, it was John and I standing in the back. Couldn't have been just a bigger, like, zero part of this dinner.
And by the way, sticking out like a sore thumb,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, you're foot taller than everyone. I'm tall, too.
I had a similar feeling. Yeah. And
they're auctioning off, like, hits with Rafa, hits with Alcaraz. Yeah. They're, like, people are just, the paddles are going up. And then they're somehow auctioning off, like, a little clinic with us.
Yeah.
Like crickets. No one wants it.
Trevor Short made us like go up and like pump up the item. I'm like, yeah, like
no, you did. I just left. They're like, all right, everyone, get the bidding up. And you're like,
yeah, it was after the hit with Rafa and Alcaraz went for like $300,000, you know? Yeah. And it's like I'm just like praying to get $5,000 maybe.
For, like, I think we just got like a little pity pay from like a turn, like an event organizer.
We did. It was all pity.
It was probably someone running the event.
Yeah,
that happened to me and James in February at the pickle slam thing. It was Agassi and McEnroe and Steffi and everyone. The amount of Steffi fans, and then James and I were just standing on the side. Like they would walk by us and shake their hands and take it.
Yeah,
I was just like, you want to go somewhere else?
Like, you don't want to be the small fish in a big pond in those deals.
You can't have the discrepancy between like the one star and the second star be like too great.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And Andre and Steffi are way up there.
I was just with Andre and Steffi in Cincinnati.
Did you play doubles with him in Cincinnati?
Oh, yeah. Well, how was that?
I was originally supposed to play with Andre. I think they changed the format the last second. Marty Fish was supposed to be part of it. He couldn't make it. He had an obligation back in L.A. And
oh, did he?
We changed it up, and I played with Andy, and we played against Andre, and then we added Tommy Paul. I mean, my first thought was like, well, just get Tommy to play it. Like, he's the best, you know. So
yeah, Andy Roddick or not Andy?
I played with Roddick. Okay. Yeah. So
did you and Roddick discuss his podcast and our podcast at all?
Oh yeah, is there beef there
in Cincinnati?
In Cincinnati, you're both there. Was there any like, hey, did he compliment our podcast?
He actually has complimented Nothing Major.
I know he's done it through text, but like in person, verbally.
I think he might have said like, you know, one of the segments, you probably saw a social clip of it.
His is good. He did a live one there. Like Andy's.
No, his is good. You know, his, as we know, his.
Andy's really good.
He hit the market, I think, at the right time. And he's like, he's got the tennis nerd audience for sure, because no one can break down a match like Andy. You know, I don't consider it competition. I just think so he's very complimentary of Nothing Major. He likes what we do. It's a little bit different.
Sandbox. We can all play on our little sides, you know.
Send him some merch.
We'll send Andy some merch for sure. But no, I played I played doubles with him against Andre and Tommy, like two total return bots.
Was Andre still on like every return?
Yeah, you could see the backhand return was just like, I aced him a few times just because I never, ever, ever hit a single ball against Andre. And like, so I've always kind of wanted to ace Andre Agassi.
Yeah, that's a cool thing.
And I was able to do that, but it was cool.
Check that off the bucket list.
Kind of a cheap shot, but.
Times where I didn't hit my spot, he was all over it. Second serve, even on that fast court, bouncing so high, he would stand in and just lace backhand returns cross court. Like, you could, it's just vintage. I mean, some things just never leave you, and his backhand.
Didn't feel comfortable in the backhand-to-backhand rally with him?
Yeah. I was
overmatched.
Serve volleying. Andre could be 90, and I'm not going to feel comfortable in that rally.
He's got such a superstar name, like AA, yeah. Andre Agassi. Is there like a better name?
I know. He's got a good name. Yeah, Tommy Paul's got a good name too. Tommy and Andre. So anyway, we lost 5-4, but it was fun.
competitive.
Being out there, and I lost with Andy against the Bryan Brothers in Atlanta a few weeks prior. And I lost with Andy at the Olympics in 2012, 6-2, 6-4. So Andy and I are 0-3 as a doubles team, yeah.
You'll never beat the bros in an exo, though.
The Bryan Brothers are the best exhibition. They're the best real doubles team of all time. And as good as they are in real doubles, they're even better in exhibition doubles. They'll beat a couple grandmas 0-0. Like, those guys are ruthless in exhibitions. Would you be tight if you're playing the U.S. Open and Andre Agassi all of a sudden came and sat in your player box?
So tight. At Wimbledon one year, I was practicing. Remember, he was working with Dimitrov a little bit. And we're on the practice courts, and right beside Dimitrov, and I'm on the ad side hitting returns, and Andre is in the space between the courts. So he's like 7 feet from me, and I'm hitting returns. I'm like, shit. Like, I don't want Andre to see me hit returns. I was so tight.
Full shank, side side foot.
He was thinking like, how bad are this guy's returns?
I was practicing against some lefty, so he's like sliding like a big slider wide. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is awful. And of course, sure enough, he hits this spot, and I shank one. Like, I catch it like so late into, like, hit it like towards Dimitrov the other side of the net, and Andre's just shaking his head. It's the worst. I was so nervous. He was way too close to me when I was hitting returns. I'm like, Macca, I just want to go get a sip of water right now. This sucks. All right, guys, let's expand on the week before the U.S. Open.
Yeah, I feel like a big part of that pre-prep week for the Open for all of us was always media day, or, you know, a lot of different media obligations or requirements.
Media day was so stupid.
Yeah.
It was like 10 reporters. They did a good job, but they would just ask the same 10 questions, and it was pretty easy.
Recycled every year. Every question, everything.
It was the same thing every year.
No one ever asked an interesting question. I don't have an example of like what I'd want a question to be, but, something other than what they were asking.
Yeah.
But the problem is it's always just, you know, very cookie cutter. It's like, oh, tennis this, how are you feeling? Are you playing? Like, there's no chance for any of us to show your personality, you know, get a different side of these things. Like, when you play tennis, or like you get to watch tennis, you get to watch the guys play, right? Like, there's no personality out. Like, who are the people outside of the courts? Like, they do such a poor job, I feel like, in highlighting what each player's interests are, their foundations, or what they're doing in their home country, their home, you know, whatever. It's like, we all see what we're doing on the court. Like, we all know, you know, oh, I did well at Cincinnati or Winston-Salem, whatever. It's like, you know, let's find out who the person is rather than just, oh yeah, how's your backhand feel today? Well, right. It's been bad for 34 straight years. Yeah. Okay.
Still bad.
Like, it's still bad. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you know.
Come in, they'd be like, you've lost 4 matches in a row. How's your confidence going? Well, thank you for that, by the way. And yeah, feel really good about winning the tournament. So.
Well, no, I think the media day stuff is kind of, it was like, to me, it was sort of like a necessary evil. Like, you know, you didn't really love doing it. But like right now, like I certainly miss, like I wish I had a media day. It's a good thing because it means you're like somewhat of a big deal, at least for that year. There are some times you wish you could just fly under the radar. But again, ultimately it's a good thing to have the media day, have people want to talk to you.
You guys all participate in Kids Day, like on Ash, I would assume at some point.
Yeah,
I did. I did once. Yeah.
I don't think I ever did Ash Kids Day because I can't do anything cool. Like, I can't hit a tweener. I literally don't know how to. I cannot hit a tweener. I cannot. Can you, Sam?
Yeah, but not like Jack or Stevie. Like, mine's pretty bad.
That was the event that I loved the most. I was like really happy I got to participate in 2016. Like, you know, you raise a bunch of money for, you know, your foundation or charity or whatever. But I felt like that was like, you know, by far the coolest piece of. Look, we all get to give back, right? I feel as if we're all entertainers. Like, you know, when you sign a kid's autograph or you know, whatever, like you never know what impact that might have on somebody, you know, some more than others. So it's whenever we were able to do stuff, you know, even in New York with the kids or with, you know, things of that nature was always like something I never tried to turn down if it was, you know, physically possible. Cause I felt like that had much more of an impact than you going to, you know, at the US Open, sitting and doing an autograph signing for like 15 minutes, just anybody can come up. You know, if there was a kids clinic or any type of those things. And I know you guys were all pretty big into that as well. So, that's kind of was like my sentiment.
You're a true sweetheart.
Well, no, yeah. Right? I mean, because like I remember as a kid, like going like for LA Open for us back in the day, that used to be a tournament. Like I remember going every year and like watching those guys, like being the kids at those clinics or whatever. And like has a big impact.
Yeah, you're right.
And they got big names to do it. I did it, I think maybe the year before that in 2015. I was like, and I wasn't even, I mean, I was a few years in on tour, but I wasn't like, and like, it was me and I think Serena and Andy Murray and somebody else. And it was like, I don't know, it's so cool. Those kids, maybe if they don't get to, you know, if they don't have the chance to get a ticket to watch Serena play or Murray play, and all of a sudden they get to watch them like outside of that, actually with a personality, I felt like on Ash and like,
yeah.
Hitting targets and
but luckily for me it was just a forehand like target hitting contest. I was like right up my wheelhouse. Like then I you know raised a bunch of money, then we did backhands. I think they took money away. So
I had to do backhands with Murray up there. It was like
kind of like match that for the kids. Like it was just like so bad. I was like, please just let me run around and hit forehands. Like or
did you slice them?
Of course. What do you mean? I hosled one into like the 74th row of Ash and then I was like slice. Just only going to slice from now on. That was a dark day.
All right, it's time for us to bring in our producer, Charlie. Charlie, what do you got for us?
All right, guys. Well, in spirit of the US Open and Media Day, we've pulled some past quotes from this group, and we're going to have you try to guess who said it. So first one, getting into it, I'm a total shoe geek.
Ready.
Sam wrote Stevie. Everyone else wrote Jack. It was Jack.
Oh, man.
But you're a total shoe geek.
Oh, geek. I didn't comprehend the question correctly.
Good call, Sam. Good call. I mean, I do love shoes outside of it, but Jack, done deal. Come on.
Yep. I have like 200 pairs of shoes. That's big thanks to Nike. I wouldn't like go buy all these shoes probably, but like when you had the freaking merch account and stuff, it was like, this is awesome.
Let's put a quick pause on this. Looks like John's having a little technical difficulties. Okay, got John back on a backup mic.
My mic went out again.
What do we do with you? I'm going to Amazon you a new cable right now.
Okay, that's the first time I've retired in a match. I'm not going to leave in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like we got a split decision here. Jack and Sam went John. Steve and John are correct. It was Steve Johnson.
Well, it's me. I was cramping 2004. It's the only match I ever retired in 2014.
Oh, the US Open.
Ito. Yeah.
Against the other Japanese guy.
Oh.
We got to avoid the Japanese players.
Yeah, two sets and a break. And they brought out a wheelchair like I was Paul Pierce. And I was like, get that thing away from me. And then I just walked off the court. A little depressed. Up two sets and a break.
I try not to make a habit of spending the whole year losing the first round.
Okay.
All right. I'm ready.
All right. I'm ready too. Ready?
Okay, go. Let's reveal. Three Sam Qs, and Sam said Stevie.
I try not to make a habit of spending the whole year losing first round. I didn't say that.
Yeah, that one was John.
Oh.
What a little poor sport.
Where did I say that?
What a sassy pants. When did you say that?
2019 Wimbledon.
All right.
Wow, not long ago either. Was that a dig at us losing a lot?
No, I don't know.
I just felt like that'd be something Goofy Sam would say.
Totally.
Moving on. I got like 50 Wimbledon towels in my locker room for my friends and family.
Oh, shoot.
Okay, guys, reveal.
Oh.
Whoa.
Got another split decision. Steve and John went John. Jack and Sam went Sam. It was Sam.
Yes.
Okay.
I've got them all at the house. I use the Wimbledon towels for like the pool to clean up messes on the ground. I dry the dog with it. I use them for every scenario you could possibly think of.
How sought after are those Wimbledon towels?
No, the Wimbledon towels are huge. For players, if you're on a court, they give you two of the nice Wimbledon towels. And after the match, I don't know if you guys remember, the ball kids always ask for the towels back. But most of the players just say no, and they stuff them in your bags. And then the ball kids don't say anything. And so for every match you play, you can get two towels. But if you have a rain delay or something,
you can
go out there, get two towels, rain delay, go back in, and they come back out, and they have two more Wimbledon towels out there. So if you have a match that's like three or four rain delays, after that match, you're walking away with 8 to 10 towels.
How many towels did you get from that Djokovic match?
I probably got 16 Wimbledon towels after that Djokovic match with all the rain delays. They're also like 200 pounds in the Wimbledon shop.
It's crazy.
Next one. I'm currently homeless, so it's an interesting situation.
Everyone's like moved around a bit. All right, I'm ready.
I'm ready.
Okay, let's do a reveal. All right, looks like we got three different answers here. Stevie, the only one going against the grain. Stevie, what do you got?
It's me, boys.
Oh.
I said Jack. Maybe doing that transition from Kansas City to Charlotte.
Like, training with Jordan.
You're living in a van somewhere.
He was getting coached by Jordan Isner.
Yeah.
I had a suitcase. I moved out of my college apartment in like July. I made third round of the Open. They're like, oh, where are you living now? I'm like, I have a suitcase and like, I have a car. That's it. And then I got an apartment shortly after, so I didn't want to be homeless. But at the time, I was currently homeless. I could probably do like one more, boys.
I'll probably get an autograph from Tiger, maybe in between sets or something. I'll bring a golf ball in there with me.
I'll be shocked if it's not the answer I picked.
Okay. Let's reveal. Sam going with Jack. Everyone else thinks it's Sam.
I did play in front of Tiger, but why would I say that?
Because you're a jock sniffer.
What are you talking about?
Oh, God.
Such a clout chaser, this guy.
It was Sam Querrey.
Yeah.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
2007 Miami.
All right, fine.
You were a wild card before facing world number one Roger Federer.
That's just something goofy you would say.
This was prime Tiger, just so you know.
Hey, Hawk 2 has sniffed that thing.
Sorry, boys. I got to run. Later, boys.
Guys, we will continue without him. My van is a 1974 Volkswagen Vanagon. It's blue and white. I had it out there at Davis Cup for the week. All the guys seem to like it.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Let's reveal. And you all got it right. It was Sam Querrey.
Yeah. I had a 1974 Volkswagen Vanagon in high school.
That's sick, actually.
Like redone, new paint job, new interior.
Pimp my ride.
Yeah, yeah. Like no middle row seats. It had a big bean bag. No nice way. Sound system. Yeah. We would put like eight guys in it and go to like the basketball games in high school and stuff.
And last but not least, if I were a pro wrestler, I'd need some sort of bad boy persona.
There's one guy in this group who would trade in his entire tennis career for one night in the ring with The Undertaker.
All right, let's reveal and see who you got. Everyone in agreement here picking John, and it's John.
Just curious, how did you get into wrestling?
I would do the fake wrestling growing up with my brothers and my friends, and I was so, so bad at it. Always something I wish I was good at, but I grew up on the WWE and still contend that it's one of the best sporting events you could possibly go to.
Would you trade in five of your tennis titles to have like a special appearance in a ring at like a WrestleMania?
Like, yes, but like it'd be kind of embarrassing because no one would know who I was. But yeah, like to get like Stone Cold, like Stunner, or like, you know, RKO'd by Randy Orton, or like Sweet Sweet chin music, excuse me, for my favorite wrestler ever, Shawn Michaels, that would be unbelievable. Dream come true for sure.
We went, what was that, Davis Cup? Was it Nashville?
In Nashville, Nashville, yeah.
Obviously, there's always a price, but like, couldn't pay me to go back to one of those. That was
so good.
The dumbest thing. You just said it's.
Dude, we met Dolph Ziggler.
I don't know who that is. I don't care who that is. I don't like.
We were sitting in the front row. You were getting hit with the sweat. It was like the greatest.
It was disgusting.
It was awesome. It was
the greatest sporting event I've ever been to.
That's ridiculous. And you even said fake. Why would you go watch people fake do stuff? Like, I cannot comprehend it.
Jack, why do you watch TV shows? They're fake.
Yes.
Thank you.
Not all of them.
No more. Okay.
Jack only watches nonfiction.
I only watch true stories.
Yeah, exactly. I just disproved your point. It's entertainment. It's scripted, just like movies are, just like TV shows are.
I'm not going to leave my home, go somewhere, go to an arena to watch people fake wrestle. It was the biggest waste of 2 hours ever.
It was awesome. Randy Orton came out from the crowd in the RKO Jinder Mahal. I remember that specifically. I mean, how good is Randy Orton's body?
I think I was playing Candy Crush the whole time.
In his skin. He's got the perfect tan. Like Randy Orton's the arm sleeves, like the tats. Like it was awesome. But, I mean, what a team bonding event, too. We played great that week.
We crushed Belgium, and it was all because we went to the WWE like 2 nights prior to the event, or 2 nights prior to playing.
I didn't realize you had such a miserable time, Jack.
I didn't either. I thought we all had a great time. This is the first I'm hearing of this.
Yeah, I would never go back. I would never.
He's been holding on to this for 10 years.
Okay, we're going to change gears a little bit, and we are going to go to some mailbag questions that we received from some listeners. I'm looking at the list, and this one just immediately popped out at me. A question came in from Lieberbaum. His username. Can Jack tell the story? You ready, Jack?
I am.
Of how he lost first round to the real estate guy. Beach. All right, Jack. It's up to you.
Like we said when we started this podcast in general, we all have thick skin and can laugh at ourselves at times and each other. And this was multiple reasons I feel like went into this famous loss to a real estate employee in Delray, who I'm assuming had to ask off of work those days to play in the tournament. And the week prior was playing in Dallas and lost to Taylor Fritz in the second round, maybe. If you listen, you don't know, I grew up in Kansas City. I'm a diehard Kansas City Chiefs fan. You never know when, you know, how many Super Bowls maybe your team will ever play in, or if it's the last during your lifetime. So I made it a point that year I was going to play. I played Dallas, and had I been out of the tournament in time, I was fortunate enough to have tickets to go to the Super Bowl in Arizona. I lost, and I went, and in my head I decided, obviously, I'm going to go to the Super Bowl. More than likely going to be fairly tired after that. Not really in a position to go play another ATP tournament right after, especially across the country. So, and I wasn't in, I don't think a wild card, I don't think was confirmed or even really talked about that much. Long story short, go to the Super Bowl. At the time, my coach called me and says, you got a wild card in Delray. I think we should go. And I was like, I am in no way, shape or form ready to go play a match in a day or two. Pretty much kind of get talked into it. Zero flights, obviously, after a Super Bowl. Cannot get to Florida. End up flying Southwest through New Orleans, I think, to get down there. Land, basically get to the hotel at 2 a.m. And I think I played that day against this phenomenal tennis player who also doubles as a real estate agent.
Do you remember his name? I don't even remember his name. Do you?
I don't think he's a real estate agent.
He worked at like a real estate firm. Like
Coldwell Banker. I just know he DM'd me after. It was like, thanks for saving my career. And I was like, really? Like, yeah.
He was already hot. You're qualified. That's right. That's right.
He was already hot, had some wins under his belt. I think he takes out anybody in the draw that day. Probably doesn't.
Hey, we have a quote from him right here. In quote, I had to leave work early today, Petkovic said. I had to send an email to the whole team. My boss let me off. I'm going to have to ask for another day off tomorrow since he beat Jack. He said he had to leave work early, so it sounds like he went into the office that morning.
Yeah, because we played at night.
Yeah,
we played at night. Yeah, he did. He probably did like 9 to 2, and then had to come over and warm up and then play.
That's a rough loss.
Yeah, that was tough. One of my more notable losses for sure. I was already in a fairly low place in the sport, and think that just helped nudge me, you know, to cross the finish line to retire.
He probably also retired after that week.
From Kirstie Bowling, who was listening, and she asked, what was your first stupid purchase after you made some serious money? Sam, I want you to take this one.
My first stupid purchase would have been 2006. I was 18 years old. I was playing a challenger in Winnetka, Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know why. I beat Rohan Bopanna in the final. And I think if you won a challenger, it was like a $50,000 challenger, you got $7,200. And I still have them today. I went and bought these stupid Gucci loafers at the Nordstrom downtown. I don't know if I've ever worn them. And I don't know what 18-year-old would want to wear these stupid things.
You still have them.
Yeah, I still have them. I still have them. I bought them in 2006. I think they were probably like $700. It was the dumbest purchase of all time. Never worn them. They're stupid looking.
They're not your style at all.
Not my style at all. I'm like a very much like wear what tennis shoe.
Especially at 18 years old.
Yeah. You just made that big check, you know?
Yeah, I wasted 10% of it on Gucci loafers. Yeah.
Would they fit? Are you same size?
Probably.
Yeah, probably fit. Yeah.
I've like moved like 10 times since then. They're all like lopsided and like smashed.
Gucci loafers.
What about you, John?
Yeah, it was in New York. Like, I bought like a watch, and I don't wear watches like at all. And I bought a watch. It was like $3,000 or $4,000, and like still have it. So like maybe it's retained it.
I bought a similar watch 2 minutes after you for the same place.
It's in the same exact place. Yes. It's Bell and Ross, remember?
Yes, exactly.
Bell and Ross sponsor us. And like I still have the watch, and it's a very beautiful watch, but like I am not a watch guy. Like I think watches are stupid. Everyone's got their phone, everyone checks their time on their phone. I think it's just a way to show off. Anyways, I never ever wore it. I still have it. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe I could sell it for $3,000 or $4,000 and get my money back. But
I'll give you $500 for it right now.
No, I think it's worth more than that.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Nothing Major. Hopefully, you're enjoying the podcast. If you are, be sure to subscribe, rate, leave us a review. We really appreciate it when you do that. Be sure to follow us on social with the handle @NothingMajorPod. If you want to join in on some of these conversations or leave us messages, you can do that. Hopefully, everyone's going to enjoy the U.S. Open. See you guys next week.
That was phenomenal.
Beautiful. All right. Thank you. Thank you.